we need to ask ourselves, is this actually beneficial? And are we being conformed into the image of God or the image of 300 something white dudes in Chicago in 1978?
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Trey Ferguson, a minister and writer who's the author of the new book, Theologizing Bigger, Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy. I was glad to be able to talk with Trey, and I think you'll find it to be an engaging and thought-provoking conversation. But before we jump into that, I want to remind you that if you haven't done so yet, you really should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness, where we produce in-depth news and analysis on faith and politics delivered straight to your inbox. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Trey Ferguson on Theologizing Bigger. Well, Trey, first of all, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, Brian. I've really been looking forward to this.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to have a conversation about your book, Theologizing Bigger, Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy. So let's maybe start with the title, and then we're going to kind of do some backstory before we dig into some of the stuff you did. I don't know if I pronounced it quite right with the theologizing. I was trying to drop my G there, like you have on the cover. But like, and you start the book talking about theologizing versus theology or being a theologian. So tell us of the kind of the what you're doing with language there in describing what you're trying to do in this book.
Yeah, a lot of times theology proper, right? Like the field of theology, when we think about it, seems like this heady academic endeavor. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that some of us feel compelled to use language that sounds more formal or more structured, like the only ways to talk about God are when we're using these words and we talk about atonement theories and we have all of the fancy words to put to them. But at the end of the day, we have real lives to live, right? And if this story of this transcendent, eternal, immutable God has any relevance to us, then it has to make sense where we live. Right. I think we do a bit of a disservice when our God talk is inaccessible to so many people. And so one of my goals in the book, all the way down to the title, is making this endeavor more accessible. And so even when I talk about the difference between theologizing and theology, it's about, oh, no, theologizing is something that all of us can do. You don't have to go to seminary. You don't have to have the right frameworks or anything or whatever. You don't have to understand all of the intricacies of orthodox theology, even though that will help in some conversations. But no, you can get into this thing of thinking about and wrestling with the reality of God where you stand, wherever you are.
Yeah, and that's such a great description of what you're doing in the book. You're dealing with deep theological issues, but you're also grounded in the real world and what's happening and how it interacts. So let's talk, before we get into some of the essays, let's talk about why you decided to write this book. Like, what was it that you said, all right, this is what I need to spend my time on. This is what I want to put out into the world.
That's a great question. And I think, if I'm all the way honest, part of it was people told me to, like, oh, you should write a book. And it was, I hear that all the time, but it's one of those things where if you hear it enough, I'm like, okay, maybe there is a need to be met here. Maybe there is a group of people who are feeling under-resourced in a certain area. And for some reason that continues to evade me sometimes, they feel as though my voice can help meet that need. And so I took it as a challenge. And then when I started like exploring the world of actual publishing, particularly in the Christian and Christian adjacent fields, I took it on a sort of a challenge because there were some people saying that they couldn't see the vision. And I had to believe like, okay, no, if there are this many people saying that their needs are unmet or that there's an itch that isn't being scratched in a particular area or whatever, then no, I think there's something that hasn't gone addressed here. And I said, okay, look, if I believe that there is something to be said, let me go ahead and say it, right? And those are kind of competing motives, not necessarily competing, but compounding motives as to why I felt that this was not only the book that I should write, but the time to do it.
So the first part of the book, you deal with the B-I-B-L-E. That's how you put it out for us, right? You're unpacking a lot of things of like, what is the Bible? And also, what is the Bible not?
Right.
And I wanted to deal with just a couple of them, just to give people a taste of what they can experience in the book. You have one chapter you describe, the Bible ain't no car manual. And I don't know about for some of the listeners. I mean, this is rhetoric that I've heard. I mean, I hear this from preachers and sermons of, you know, the Bible's the owner's manual. Right? You need to get in it, and right, and you can't drive a car without an owner's manual. You can't live life without an owner's manual. Like, this kind of rhetoric is out there in the evangelical world. So if the Bible's not a car manual, what is it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a companion. It's a guide. In that this is not the step-by-step instructions for how to live life, but the actual musings and the actual reflections of people trying to figure out what that life looks like in light of this transcendent and eternal God. So when we're wrestling with the word of God, particularly as it pertains to the Bible, and it talks about, have your word deep in my spirit, right? Like, I meditate on your word daily, or your law, as the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament will often say. The idea here is not necessarily they're staring at a Bible or a scripture. As a matter of fact, in Jewish tradition, the idea that God's eternal word or law is revealed in part through the Torah, right? The law is a gift that is something that, you have helped us in this way. Now we have some insight into the way. And that is talking about the Torah, which is both like the five books of Moses and this like eternal principle that exists. That's more built upon when we think about like the concept of the Logos in the New Testament, the word, even though the Torah is still present there, the Nomos in the New Testament in the Greek. But like this idea of, how are we supposed to live? The Bible is people documenting what they believe that to be and wrestling with that. The Bible is not in and of itself that word or that law or anything. It's people like, it is documenting pieces of the revelation, right? So it's almost as though if you were to send a bunch of journalists to the Super Bowl, you will find different stories as different aspects. Like they will leave with different impressions about the important things that transpired during that game. If the Logos or the law or the divine will and principle of God is what is in focus here, in the Bible, we have a collection of people, journalists, poets, prophets, all of these things witnessing to what that thing is and how life has been lived and ought to be lived in light of that principle, right? And so we have things that are criticizing people for not living up to whatever that standard is. We have people who are pointing out exactly what they believe that standard to be, people trying to distill basic ethic principles or frameworks for that. And there's a lot of different musings about this, but one thing it is very clearly not, for the most part, is a list of instructions. There are certain lists of instructions, but no, there's some. You have Psalms in there that are just literally musings about God. We have Proverbs, which are quick little quips of wisdom that we could take. We have stories being told in the Gospels, and stories being told in the book of Esther, and stories being told throughout the books of Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and all these things. And if we're just focused on instructions, then we'll lose a lot of what is being offered for our consideration here.
Yeah, I just wanted to note, as someone in Missouri, that when you gave your Super Bowl example, I think the important thing was just who won. But anyways, I know there's other things journalists can focus on.
That is true, man. Y'all are getting greedy out there. Y'all are getting comfortable. I ain't even mad at it, man. We never seen nothing like that, man, number 15.
The child version of me still doesn't understand how it's happening. So. So one of the issues that you unpack a bit in as you're thinking about the Bible is the issue of inerrancy. And you go back to the Chicago Statement, but you help contextualize like what's really happening. Like, why are we even seeing this rhetoric? Here's a little bit of what you wrote. Statements on, quote, biblical inerrancy do not happen in a vacuum. They happen when there is a concern that some people are ascribing significance to the wrong issues. It is no coincidence that around the same time that the social fabric of the United States began to disintegrate, a group with an astonishingly high proportion of white male representation gathered to set the record straight. The 1970s saw the anti-war, feminist, and black power movements in full swing. As subsequent statements on, quote, biblical hermeneutics and, quote, biblical application would demonstrate, the Chicago Statement was as much about restoring, quote, order as it was what the Bible actually said. And then you added a couple paragraphs later, there is harm in baptizing an interpretation of the Bible as, quote, inerrant. So help us, I mean, because this is a term we still see thrown out a lot, particularly in white evangelical circles. What's happening here with inerrancy? What's really happening? Again, as you're trying to tell us, this isn't about the Bible as much as it's about us and culture around us.
Yes. I think what's important for us to reckon with is the fact that, or the reality that, the very concept of orthodoxy is a political construct. And I'm not saying that to diminish or denigrate orthodoxy, but orthodoxy is less about thus saith the Lord and more about thus saith a sufficient number of authorized people who have been empowered with setting and passing down boundaries. That's what orthodoxy is there to do. It's there to define the boundaries of what is and is not proper. And that is done by people who have been authorized to do so. Even when you think about Nicene orthodoxy, what most people consider like the Christian standard or whatever, that was in a council of bishops that was convened by a secular emperor at the time. We can't separate these things. So the idea of what is and is not right is always a matter of how many people we can get on the same page, right? That's orthodoxy in general, or whatever we view as proper doctrine. So when we talk about the Chicago Statement in particular, what we got to look at is, okay, who's in the room deciding all this stuff? It's almost exclusively white conservative evangelical males, right? And I think the most like diversity you would have in that room are people who disagree on things like what we now recognize as complementarianism versus egalitarianism, even though that wasn't really a debate at that time. That actually comes a little bit later. But there's not a lot of, there wasn't a very ecumenical statement, right? And it happens in response to a lot of cultural issues in America, cultural upheaval, and where some people see, particularly some of the mainline Protestant denominations fitting into the larger cultural discourse. And when we view the conclusions there, like things about inerrancy as something that, oh no, these people just went to the Bible and this is what they came out with, we have to ask ourselves, why didn't anybody come up with this exact statement in the 1800 years previous of Christian history? It's like, no. And this isn't me saying that, oh, they're running afoul. This is what people do. We wrestle with scripture and tradition and our experience, and we try to come up with something that is not only orthodox, but fruitful and beneficial. Where that becomes problematic is when in that process, we exclude large swaths of people and then assume that everybody, even people who were not included in that process of wrangling with this scripture and the tradition, that everybody has to abide by this outcome. Because what happens when you do that is we are saying something very loudly about who we view as authorized to reach these conclusions. Like that is an inescapable conclusion. If I look at the list of people who signed that statement, the almost 400 people who signed that statement, and recognize that, oh, nobody who experienced life in an even sort of similar way to me was in the room, I have to ask, why is it that I feel compelled to alter my faith and my hermeneutic to what they view as proper? Right? And then that becomes a project in assimilation and conformity, which we need to ask ourselves, is this actually beneficial? And are we being conformed into the image of God or the image of 300 something white dudes in Chicago in 1978?
So this raises, I think, a really kind of good pivot point, because the second section of your book, you're wrestling with the black church tradition you grew up with and some of the white church theology that dominates the evangelical world. And you read at one point in the book, you said, I'm a product of the Black church. And while I've never used the word evangelical to describe my faith, it is often a fair descriptor of some of the things that I was raised to value. And I wanted to just take a moment to kind of unpack that there, because, I mean, this is something that's not uncommon. There's a lot of Black Christians in the United States who are very evangelical in their theology, but don't use that label. And right. I think of particularly like Barack Obama, when he was running for president the first time, was asked if he was an evangelical. And if you listen to his rhetoric and you listen to the way he talks about his faith, he's very evangelical sounding. Right. But he explained that he doesn't use that label, and he explained that he shies away from it because some of the political connotations. So I wonder if you could talk about that context of feeling both theologically connected to the evangelical world and yet also separated from it.
Yeah, I think it was Bebbington who like tried to provide like the actual definition of evangelicalism, right? They call it the Bebbington Quadrilateral. We're looking at things like conversionism, like bibliocentrism or biblicism, and the things that identify what it means to be an evangelical on that theological level would all apply to most of the Black church tradition. And I need to be clear in saying like, oh, there's not all Black Christians would fall into what I'm talking about as the Black church tradition here, because there are Black Roman Catholics, there are Black Amish communities in America, right? Like, this is a very diverse thing we're talking about when we talk about Black Christians. But as far as the Black church tradition, that thing which evolves from the hush harbors of the antebellum South and all of those things, they would largely fit into that. And some of that has to do with the fact that much of the Black church tradition can be traced to the conversionism of the Great Awakenings, right? Just historically speaking, anthropologically speaking, that makes sense. But at the same time, the Black experience impacted that faith tradition in a way that did not touch much of their white evangelical counterparts, right? And so there is often a thirst for justice and righteousness and a prophetic tradition that speaks back to the stories that we are handing down that is present in the Black church tradition that is not as valued in what we now recognize as white evangelicalism. And so because that whole history and tradition is largely absent from the image that is evoked when we say evangelical, there's not a whole lot of Black people who, theologically speaking, are or would qualify as evangelicals that would wear that label. It is sort of similar, I guess, in a way, like when we talk about Black people, there's often like the modifiers, right? Like we have Black Americans or African Americans, all of these things, because, oh yeah, like we are fully American, right? Thanks to the 14th Amendment and all these things, like, oh, we are Americans, but there is something unique about our experience. There's something, when you look at us, you could tell that we are going to experience a lot of things differently. We have that little modifier, whereas a lot of white Americans or even evangelicals get to live their life without that hyphen, right? There's nothing separating them in that way from what is evoked in the imagination when we use these words, whether that's evangelical or American in this illustration.
Yeah, and we do that theologically, right? So we'll have the, you know, Black theology, but then we call white theology just theology.
Correct.
And
yeah.
So there's this assumption that that's the standard. And what you do, you know, that I think is important is recognizing that there is white theology. You talk about white man's religion and the different emphasis through history and through life experiences that read the text differently. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about how does it change to read the Bible from the perspective of, you mentioned the hush harbors already, from people descended from enslaved people. That's a different way of reading the Bible than reading it from a position of power, privilege, and even the position of enslavers.
Yes, that's a great question. And for me, what it comes down to essentially is what we are envisioning, imagining, perceiving that we need salvation from. If you live a relatively comfortable life wherein your highest aspiration is to climb higher on the ladder of meritocracy, quote unquote meritocracy or whatever, then what you need salvation from is some nebulous concept of sin, the inherent desires within us that keep us from following in the way of Jesus, right? And sure, that there is an aspect of truth in that. If, however, you experience life as someone who has been under the threat or reality of exile or colonization or enslavement, then you actually need salvation from the sins, not only of yourself and of your mind and of your constitution, but other people and the sins of the world against you that are like keeping you from experiencing the abundant life in the here and now. And that is not like a Marxist principle. We see that happening in the Bible. The Ten Commandments start with, I am the Lord your God, who got you out of slavery in Egypt. God identifies as a liberator and not of just this mental slavery to sin or anything. No, I delivered you from slavery in Egypt. A large part of why people have a hard time conceiving of a crucified Messiah is because what they were expecting was someone who would deliver them from the reality of the Roman Empire. Now, the fact that deliverance looks different than what people were expecting speaks loudly, but it does not change the fact that, no, based upon what you are experiencing frames how you are understanding this concept of salvation. And so people who can only think of salvation from something that is living in your head, then presenting their faith as the solution to people who need salvation from conditions that are largely perpetuated by the people preaching this heady salvation or whatever, like that makes a difference. And you even see that happening, like you said, we mentioned the hush harbors already, when the people who are sitting in the bondage of enslavement in the Americas hear the story of the Exodus, they're not thinking, oh, I need salvation for my soul. They say, oh, wow, God freed people, right? God freed actual temporal people from actual temporal situations here. And that's actually good news to a great deal of people. And so the way that they're receiving these stories and sitting with these stories and thinking about this God of salvation and thinking about the fact that Emmanuel means God with us, the us that they're thinking of is different than the us that a comfortable person is thinking of, right? When you think about Jesus and the name actually meaning God saves, Yeshua, that being like God saves us from this situation, it's going to hit different depending on how you live your life or where you live your life in the social hierarchy.
So, you know, we talked earlier about how you're trying to come to this way that's not just academic theology, and you know, you have a lot of personal stories you draw from pop culture. And I wasn't going to necessarily mention that you start a chapter with examples from the Black Panther, except for people are just listening, but we can see each other. And then you got three things on your wall behind you, and two of them are Black Panther related. So I had to point that out. As soon as you came on screen, I was like, okay, so the Black Panther example was not just like a, you know, one-off. Like this is something that you're into. So, I mean, talk about that. I mean, how does even something like a comic strip and movies based on comics, like how does that help you in thinking about God and the Bible and what does it mean to be a Christian?
That is a great question. So I love Black Panther and the comics and all that stuff, because it is an example of what is known as Afrofuturism, right? Where a lot of Black creatives will make art based on the imagination of all of the possibilities that could exist for Black people. And I talk about this in the book. When Black Panther comes out in February of 2018, Black people showed up in the movie theaters dressed like King Joffy Joffy from Coming to America. And it was a really proud moment, because it was a movie that did not depict Black people as enslaved. Instead, Black people were the progenitors of an advanced society, an advanced civilization that became the envy of the world, right? And through that artistic process, what we are actually dealing with is the human imagination unleashed from the shackles of the horrors of our history. Like, if this did not define us, right? If all of the ugly things in our past did not define us, what could we possibly achieve? And I think that is a very helpful framework to think of what salvation looks like. Were we not shackled by the chains of sin in our mind, right? The sin that we need salvation from, even if it's just of the mental and heady variety that we talked about a moment ago, what realities could we possibly imagine? And I think that's actually part of what we're called to. When we're made in the image of God, that said, about a God who speaks things into creation, right? God sees things in the mind of God and then calls them into being. And we are created in that very image. We have this creative capacity for a reason, because we're made in the image of God. And when Jesus teaches the disciples to pray, he says, pray on earth as it is in heaven. That which you hope for, we need to pray that that comes to being right here and right now. And so I actually love the creative capacities of people. And Black Panther's behind me because it's easier to find those portions. I love all sorts of Afrofuturistic content and comics. Like Bitterroot is another great comic I love. I don't have any of the blow-ups behind me because I haven't been able to find them in the Burlington Coat Factory yet. But at the end of the day, the idea that creative people can sit around dreaming up these new realities and then spinning them in a way that captivates people, that is the power of the story of Jesus. Were we not scared of what death looks like? Were we not scared of what living self-sacrificially would lead us? In light of the resurrection of Jesus, how can we live our lives to bring heaven to bear on earth?
Yeah, I mean, and the way you just talked about that, I mean, that's the work of prophets in scripture, is right. They're dreaming and imagining a world that isn't, but that could be. They're trying to help us realize that things don't have to be the way that they are. I mean, that's what theology and prophetic work is all about. It's not about, you know, predicting the future or, you know, just some sort of private internal thing. It's about how could this world be different if yes. we would allow ourselves to move into that existence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really what this is about. Because when you think about hope, it is grounded in the idea that what we see is not all there is. And that the same God who created in the beginning is still in the process of laying out the universe around us and in front of us. The call to follow Jesus is about tracking God in the land ahead. The story is not over. Though the canon is closed and the Bible is complete, the story of the universe that we're being invited into is really still unfolding in front of us. And our hope is in the idea that this God, this immutable and eternal God, is fundamentally good in nature, and that what lies ahead has to be better than what we are currently experiencing. And so when we have the prophets and things like that, they're calling us back to the character of this God, knowing that, as it says in Ephesians, like eyes have not seen and ears have not heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man the good things. For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper, plans for your welfare and not for your harm. Like God says, what you're going through right now is not the end of the story. And a good prophet will draw you into that reality, into that story, and encourage you to leave behind or to hold loosely the things that are and to pursue the things that are to come, the things that are still yet to be, right?
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation. So as you continue to kind of unpack and look at some of these differences and the importance and the meaning of it, you give us two people who were contemporaries. They're growing up about the same time. They're both Baptist ministers. You're smiling because you already know where I'm going because you wrote the book, right? But I mean, even people who are listening might start to guess. But you give us Jerry Falwell and Martin Luther King Jr., Baptist ministers in the South, born just 4 years apart, and yet very different visions of the gospel and yes. what it looks like in life today. I mean, how we theologize about things really has an impact.
Yes. Yes, it does. And I think drawing that out is very important because there was recently a bit of, I guess you can call it controversy, when a prominent evangelical minister, like I guess one of the popes of evangelicalism nowadays, a man by the name of John MacArthur, recently said that, oh, Martin Luther King Jr. was not a Christian. And okay, he gets to say ridiculous things. He says lots of ridiculous things and we accept it because he says them in a sports coat. It sounds authoritative. But at the end of the day, what we have to acknowledge is that what people view as right and proper and aligned with God is largely framed not only by what they've inherited, but how they experience life. Jerry Falwell Sr., or Jr. for that matter, John MacArthur, John Piper, never walked a day in the life, never walked a mile in the shoes of somebody like Martin Luther King Jr. Never had their house bombed for trying to speak up for people. They were not assassinated on the steps of the Lorraine Motel. And I'm not sure if they've ever had a fear that that would be the case. And that is how Martin Luther King Jr. lived his life, with that fear, knowing that this could cost me my life. Now, in light of what I've just painted and presented for you, a fair question when we're theologizing is, which of those two experiences and realities sounds more like the way of Jesus Christ? Which one of those realities sounds more like somebody who took seriously the call to take up your cross and follow me? Which one of those people sounds more like they were prepared to die on the cross with Jesus? And of course, I'm trying to lead. That's a leading question because the answer sounds fairly obvious in my book. But at the end of the day, many people have accepted both of those presentations, right? The Falwell / MacArthur presentation of the gospel and the vision of Martin Luther King as legitimate when they are sort of antithetical, right? And to call one valid and not only valid, but proper, admirable, and aspirational is almost of necessity to look at the other one and call it false, right? So if you are going to put a gun to my head and make me choose between the two, then I'm probably going to try to pick the one that looks a little bit more like Jesus, even if it seems more absurd, because the Bible does say that the wisdom of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. And so even if it seems like, oh, this can't be the way, like, Jesus was viewed as heterodox by a lot of his contemporaries. So I'm not intimidated by powerful people, people sitting at the seat of religious power in our current context, saying that, oh, this was unorthodox and he should have lived his life this way. Oh, that sounds very familiar, actually. That sounds like the story of the guy we're supposed to be following according to these scriptures. And so when we look at how these stories map onto each other, right? The story of a first century Galilean preacher and the stories of people living in the 20th and 21st century America, I think there are a lot of parallels that are kind of striking if you sit down and think about it. Not to say there's a perfect analog, but when we actually reflect on who we're mapping as the good guys, the ones who look like Jesus, and the ones that we are painting as the dangerous guys, I think it ought to encourage us to pause and reflect on if we've lost the plot.
Yeah, you use the word mapping, which is the metaphor in that chapter with an old, outdated GPS, right? And so if we're following the wrong map, it may not get us to where we think it's supposed to take us. And the John MacArthur example is such a great one. I'm sure if it had happened like a year ago, it would be in the book, because it's such a perfect example of exactly what you're arguing. Because, I mean, here we have a man who has in the past defended the institution of slavery and continues to lift up enslavers as biblically orthodox theologians worthy of following and emulating and quoting.
Right.
And then yet, but King's not a Christian. So the enslavers are orthodox theologians and King's not a Christian. I mean, that's a faulty map that's taking us to the wrong place.
I think it's important to name that exactly as you've done, because one of the other things I argue in the book is that, like, when beliefs become the boundaries, then we're going to invite a lot of posers, of grifters into our midst. Because what good is a belief if you can hold that belief and still live your life raggedy? And John MacArthur's argument is that though Martin Luther King stood for good things, because he didn't articulate the beliefs the exact way he wanted them to, then he is not a Christian. Okay, if that's what Christianity is, what value is Christianity? Is the label Christian what saves you, or is following the way of Jesus what saves you? If Martin Luther King one time wrote a paper that articulated the Trinity in a way that makes you uncomfortable, despite the fact that there is no articulation of the Trinity in the scriptures that you claim that we're supposed to be following, if that is what disqualifies him for this label that you are holding up as aspirational, then what good is the label? Did Martin Luther King live his life in a way that honors Jesus? Did he point people toward Jesus? And I think most people would answer that as yes. I do suspect that the people that we've named earlier, like John MacArthur and Jerry Falwell Sr. or whatever, would argue that no, Martin Luther King did not do that, right? I think that would be a legitimate argument, and that is precisely why I'm not prepared to take them more seriously than I have to.
As if we haven't made your book sound controversial enough. You also have a chapter going on after the American Dream, and another one on, and American exceptionalism, and then later we take on capitalism. I mean, this is some pretty crazy, dangerous stuff you're doing here.
Yeah, I am not smart enough to be afraid, right? And so one of the benefits to me choosing the publishing route that I did, where I went with a hybrid publisher, is that I was involved heavily in almost every stage of the book and was granted a large degree of autonomy in what came out of this book, right? And so I talk a bit about like what was bequeathed to me by my ancestors, right? My father was a Jamaican immigrant who dropped out of high school, still went to an Ivy League school, dropped out of that too because he felt like it, and marched with the Young Lords. And I found out after my father passed that he was one of them revolutionaries who used to get locked up on a fairly consistent basis for protesting and stuff like that. That's the stuff that's in my DNA, right? And so when I marry that with my faith and my belief in the power of not only the resurrected Jesus, but the story of Jesus and what this actually tells us about living in this life, then I feel compelled to speak hard truths, even when they are discomforting to the stories that we've accepted. If you are familiar with the history of Christian thought, you will, or hopefully, deduce that I'm not really saying anything heterodox in as far as my Christian beliefs go. I'm pretty much in line with a lot, not all of them, but many of the early church fathers and everything. Like, no, my beliefs are there. But I also believe that where God placed me when he knit me together in my mother's womb, when that occurred, it was intentionally in this setting that I would see and experience the world in this way. I don't feel compelled to deny these parts of my identity as I think about the story of God. I think I would actually be doing a disservice to the creator of heaven and earth if I just pretended I was doing all of this stuff in a vacuum. And so a lot of the things that you see, like the controversial aspects from me being like, oh no, this is true. This is true of the way that I've experienced the world. And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be this way. So when I say controversial things, it is not exclusively for the purpose of generating reaction, even though sometimes I am intentionally provocative. The goal there is that we would come to notice something that we have taken for granted and ask ourselves if we have to continue taking this for granted. Is this serving not only us, but our neighbors well, or is there a better way?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. That's what you do in the book, is you're challenging us to consider some of these things that might be more American than gospel.
Right.
Because the whole point is to get us back to what Jesus was trying to teach us and tell us. This is how you put it at one point in the chapter when you're talking particularly about American exceptionalism. You're right. The choice of the church between empire and kingdom, that's the choice between empire and kingdom, will direct the imagination of the church. Will we be bound by the concept of scarcity? Or will we enter a reign in which 5 barley loaves and 2 fish are more than enough to feed a multitude for an afternoon? These are two vastly different ways of viewing the world. One of the ways accords with almost everything we've known and seen. Scarcity makes sense. It validates the principles of law and order that make us feel safe and civilized. But scarcity always creates losers, and Jesus stands with them on purpose.
This is a weird phenomenon where when other people read my words, it sounds better than it did in my head when I lied. We should do this more often. Oh,
good. I'm glad that I didn't like make it sound boring.
Yeah, that's it. Like you were reading, I was like, wow, that sounds dope. And it took a minute for me to realize, I was like, oh, wait, no, I wrote these words. We're talking about a book that I wrote. That was,
I think that was brilliant. Yeah. I mean, hey, yeah, that's what you want to say,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But that's the truth of the matter at the end of the day. Narrow is the way. And I think that these are words that are often minimized in our Christian imagination. We think that that is a pithy statement about what it means to live piously. And we got to make sure that we're saying the right prayers and believing the right things. Whereas Jesus makes it relatively clear in a number of different ways. He's talking about a radical reorienting of our values. When he speaks to the rich young ruler, who says that, oh, I followed all the commands and I've done all these things. And Jesus says, good job. It's one thing you haven't done. Get rid of all this stuff, give your possessions to the poor, and then come follow me. Like, that's a lot to ask somebody. So when we act as though just believing the right thing, saying the sinner's prayer, going to church on a regular basis, being pro-choice, never voting for Democrats or whatever is all that is required of us. No, we are missing a large part of the story. There's a reason that some of the earliest Christian communities had like spinoffs of people who decided that asceticism was the life that they were called to live, and to live in these enclaves of voluntary poverty and all these things. Some people felt like, oh, this is actually what Jesus is calling us to. Now, that is an extreme, and I don't know if all of us are called to live that life, but I think that there is something to learn there. If we're not giving up anything and we're just comfortable living like in these privileges and saying that because we believe the right things and we are spreading these beliefs to people across the world that we're doing something for Jesus, I think we got to ask ourselves if that's really what it means to deny ourselves, take up our crosses, and follow Jesus.
So as you get to the end of the book, the key issue that you really kind of come to and end on is this idea of thinking about God as love. And that love is, it's the commandment to us to love God, love others. And God, and if God is love, then that changes what it means to follow God. As we get near the end of our time here, I wonder if you can talk about why that is so important. Like, how does focusing on God as love, how does that change, or how should it change, then everything else?
When love is the focus and the primary means by which we seek to understand God, the God who many scriptures are adamant is invisible, like we cannot see who this God is, the clearest picture that we have is the person of Jesus Christ, who is fully God, right? And I'm not doing heresies right here. I'm talking about scripture. In 1 John chapter 4, no one has ever seen God. It says that straight up, right? But God is identified in that same letter as love. Whoever lives in love lives in God. The question then becomes, what is love? Because some people talk about speaking the truth in love, and they use that as license to be jerks for Jesus. They assume if you just say the word love, it is sufficient to actually do this. But Jesus says straight up that a new commandment I give you, to love one another. And in that very same passage says, and no greater love is this than to lay down your life for one's friend. Love is the very nature of sacrifice. Well, one of my mentors, the Reverend Dr. Jeremy H. Upton, says that love is the giving of all that one is, has, and does for the positive benefit of another, expecting nothing in return. That's pretty long. I've committed it to memory. Some people will struggle with that. Love, as I would define it, is the commitment to wholeness. The wholeness of others would be to love someone else. If I love you, I'm committed to your wholeness. If I love myself, then I'm committed to my wholeness. If I love the creation of God, then I'm committed to its wholeness. And that commitment is a decision. It's not a feeling. It's not an emotion. It is a decision to work toward the wholeness of something else. If that is where the character of God is grounded and where we are called to, it makes sense of almost everything in the Bible, from the creation to the Exodus even to the exile and thinking, for I know the plans I have for you. It is for your wholeness because I love you. And sometimes that commitment will lead us to things like discipline. Like, oh, because I am committed to your wholeness, there is a process that we have to go through to separate you from the things that are actually taking away or standing in the way of your wholeness, right? I discipline my children because I love them. I will take away your iPad because I recognize that this relationship that you are developing with all of these things is not actually contributing to your wholeness, that you are not becoming the best version of yourself with this habit. And so we will try to work around that habit some way, somehow. That is what a commitment to wholeness looks like. But if that commitment is what grounds our ethics, our witness, our testimony, and everything, then we are showing up in love. If I'm committed to your wholeness, what that means is I don't ground your belief or your orthodoxy or lack thereof as I don't use that as the gauge for how I meet you. No, I am committed to your wholeness because I believe that you are made in the image of God, even if you don't yet, right? When we have the parable of the lost coin, the coin doesn't lose its value because it is lost and dirty or whatever. No, as a matter of fact, the fact that it is lost is what sends us on that search. I need to bring you back into the fold because you still have, you're just as valuable as you were when you were clean and in my possession, right? Love, this commitment to wholeness, will reorient our values and our ethics to the point where we will give up of ourselves in order that somebody else might experience the wholeness of God. And when you are trusting in the faithfulness of God, we're not afraid of that self-sacrifice because we believe that God will cover whatever it is that we're giving up. That's the story of the resurrection. No greater love than to lay down your life for one's friend. And Jesus does that knowing that he hasn't met anybody with that same commitment as him, but trusting that God won't let it go in vain at all. And what do we see? He's raised back to life. And so even if we're afraid that, oh, we won't see the resurrection in due time, if our faith is in God and the character of God and the power of the Holy Spirit to transform people around us, we don't lose anything in love, in that self-sacrificial commitment to the wholeness of others and creation, because there's somebody there who is committed to our wholeness. And even if we can't name who that person is, if there is a God who is love, who is the commitment to our wholeness, then there is nothing that can separate us from God's love, from God's commitment to wholeness, even death itself. I'm talking through scriptures right now. You understand? Like, that's the story of God.
Well, there's so much more that we could do, but we'll leave the rest of it as a mystery, so people have to pick up the book.
I think that's a good idea.
I thought you'd agree. The book is Theologizing Bigger: Homilies on Living Freely and Loving Holy. Trey, thanks so much for joining us on the program, but even more so for laying all this out there for us to think about and to work on.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me again, Brian. This has been a blessing in ways that I failed to fully anticipate. It was my favorite type.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.